Is everybody ready? All right. Let's get started. So last Thursday we talked a little bit about ethics, and I brought up the issue of the privilege of owning a gun. And there's been a news story out of Iowa where they looked at gun owners who are blind. So they actually came up in court whether or not a person who is blind can own a gun. And the result of that is that they said it's okay for everybody to have a gun. And I'll send you on Friday the article, and there's a video that goes along with it that shows a blind person using a gun at a target range, and he was doing actually pretty good. But I thought I'd ask Kartik his opinion on the subject, if I might impose on you, on your thoughts about that.
I think I pretty much agree. So the name of the person is Michael, and he's and he's president of the local National Association of Blind Chapter in Iowa. And so I think I pretty much agree with him. When it comes to all laws, there has to be equity, and that he's been using his gun for quite a while now. And so he explained this to a couple of groups who were opposing him owning a gun, and then he's like, "What are you saying? Just because I'm blind doesn't mean that I'll shoot blindly." he shows very dedicated and extremely ridiculous at this. So I guess there are people like him who really, can prove that, yeah, it's perfectly possible for someone who's really impressed to own a gun and he can use it.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, he talked about defense at home, but he practices at a shooting range. So, he was concerned about, safety as well as recreational uses of a gun. Okay. Okay. So, upcoming lectures on Thursday, Gary Burke is going to be here talking about prosthetics. It ought to be a really interesting talk, so you don't want to miss that. And next Tuesday at this time, we're having an assistive technology fair. There's about 10 vendors who will come just for you. They're not going to be, I told them, they're not going to make any sales. They're here to give you information. So they'll be setting up in here and just outside in the breezeway, perhaps. So you're going to ask them about their products, about how they designed it. Where it's used, their methodology and why it's superior to other products on the market. So you're going to go around and talk to every vendor. There's only about 10 of them. But there'll be some really interesting ones. There'll be a really neat-looking wheelchair, and there'll be a fella communicating through a beam telepresence robot. And he's a fella that I talked about, Henry Evans, who has a severe disability. He can't speak, so he uses a speech synthesizer on his computer, and he's going to operate this from Los Altos. And I think he's going to play a little, he's going to kick a soccer ball around as well. So that'll be really interesting. Okay. And a week from Thursday is the student team midterm presentations. I'll talk more about that on Thursday. We'll have sign-ups for the positions as well. And then in 2 weeks from today, we'll have our first tour of the VA. And in preparation for that, I have a list for drivers, for people who can drive some of the students to the event, not only this event, but the event at the Motion and Gait Lab. 2 weeks beyond that, or a week beyond that. So indicate on here if you have a car and you're willing to chauffeur people to the VA or Menlo Park, and how many passengers you can take and your phone number and stuff like that. So I think I'll just pass this around. And then later on we'll have passengers sign up for a particular driver. So, okay. When a student says said, it'd be nice to have the main web links available so they can access this pretty easily. So here they all are. And I should note that this document, as well as other documents, are posted on the course website. By tomorrow they'll all be posted. So if you don't take good notes, you can refer to this online. Okay. The anonymous suggestion box is always open for your comments, both good and bad. So let me know. The sign-up sheet for people working on projects to meet with me is over here. I have one for next week, so you can meet with me during the week or just before or after class, whatever suits you best. I talked about the sign-up sheet. People are being pretty good about sending me your progress reports. I really want to know that you're working on stuff. I really want to share your successes, and I really want to, score what you're doing to know what you're doing, so I can say good work. That's really important. For the midterm project presentations, a week from Thursday, we'll have only about 5 minutes per team because we have a lot of teams. But 5 minutes is enough because if you go visit your congressman in Washington, D.C., how many minutes do you get? You get 5 minutes. So you need to make a good case with your congressman as well as your midterm presentation. Okay. So I have a sign-up sheet for when you present on Thursday. I want to talk a little bit about the weekly information I send out on Fridays. I've got a couple comments where people had thought that the document was too long because I actually have to address the needs of students and students working on team projects, students working on individual projects, and students just taking the course for a seminar. So I think the problem is that even though I put these in colored boxes and everything, it's really still sort of hard to follow. So I think a solution that I'm going to try is to send out information for all the students with links back to the website, a web page for specific information for these groups. Does that sound like a good plan? Is anybody else having a problem with following all that information? Okay, it was just a couple people. All right. So some of the stuff is new items and some of the stuff are reminders, but it's all good information. So you need to scan the stuff quick for the things that make sense. So on Thursday, again, we're going to have Gary Burke, and he's been very involved with prosthetics and this class and other classes at Stanford over the years. He's been a great resource, not only of expertise in the area, but also a great source of projects. So we get to hear from him directly on Thursday. But today, Allison and I are going to be talking about robots. And what we'll do now is we'll take a short break, have Allison set up for her presentation. In that time, please sign in if you haven't. Sign up for a meeting, have a cookie, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you. Okay, we can move this closer. And I actually have another VGA cable. This doesn't work out. I have a microphone for recording.
China, you think? Okay. Let's see. I need to... Let me just check this. Okay, that works. What does the actual class time end? Does it end at 5:30?
5:30, yeah.
Okay.
But take as much time as you
okay.
need. And I got a lot of stuff, but it's all
it's like
just
whatever will go at the end, yeah. Okay. Okay. So I could take, so you, I'll just take questions after I, while and after I talk.
Yeah, after your presentation, take questions.
Okay. Okay, great. You got a bigger crowd than usual this year. Yeah.
And there's a bunch of community people here, and some people from Benetech.
Uh-huh. What's Benetech?
Benetech is a company in California Avenue in Palo Alto, and they do a lot of stuff with global literacy and Bookshare and Bookshare. So they look at people who are both illiterate and
I see. Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Cool. Hi, I'm ready to go whenever you guys are.
You should have used highlighters.
Engineer by training. I was actually an undergraduate at Berkeley and a PhD student here at Stanford. And I was really throughout my PhD working on very classical robotics problems. How do you get robot hands and fingers to pick up and manipulate objects in an autonomous fashion, and what kind of sensing and artificial intelligence was involved? When I started my faculty career, I took a faculty job at Johns Hopkins University originally. I moved here a few years ago. And part of the reason I went to Johns Hopkins is I was interested in applying robots to what I thought would be really important and motivating problems, particularly in healthcare. So as you guys probably know, Johns Hopkins is best known for its medical school, not so much for mechanical engineering, although we're quite good at that too there. And I got involved in two main areas of research while I was there. One was in using robots for interventional applications like surgery and interventional radiology procedures, working with people like surgeons, cardiologists, etc. And then I also started working in a very different area of robotics, which is rehabilitation or movement therapy robots. I've also been a little bit related to prosthetics and other types of human-machine interactions for retraining or replacing lost limb function. So what I'm going to do in this talk is kind of has two parts. One is to give you an overview of the field of movement therapy robots, why they're needed, what patient populations can use them, and just a smattering of examples of what kinds of systems have been built. and what they're good for. And then the second half is just about highlighting one of the research projects in my lab. So not necessarily something that's being used in rehabilitation clinics, but to kind of show you some of the research problems that we try to solve in this area that it combines both robotics and understanding of human movement and neuroscience. So we'll cover those two parts. So the first thing to ask about rehab robotics is what patient populations are relevant here. And stroke is by far the big one. These numbers are already a little outdated. I think they're from 2012. And there are so many people who have a stroke every year, and that results in loss of movement, loss of capabilities, loss of speech, other deficits as well. And the cost. And when you write grant proposals, you get all these cost numbers so you can and put these forward as motivation for funding your research. But the cost is truly astronomical, you know, not just to people's personal lives and outlook, but just to the economy in terms of not only the lost work of the people who could be working but now have some movement deficit, but also in terms of the people that have to care for them. And so there's a lot of motivation, especially in countries that have a growing elderly population, to be concerned about stroke in particular. This is definitely of interest here in the U.S., but if you look at countries like Japan and Italy, which have a really growing aging population in comparison to young people, you have more and more problems with issues like stroke. Cerebral palsy is just another example, as well as orthopedic interventions. These are all places where you would like to have some sort of movement therapy. Okay, but why a robot instead of a human therapist? And I think even using the word instead is not quite the right word. It's in addition to a human therapist. As with many medical robots, the way that I pitch it is not that we're trying to replace human caregiving, but in a lot of cases there are capabilities that robots have that people don't. And you could potentially decrease the cost of care, increase the frequency of say, movement exercises in comparison to what a human therapist could do. All right, so while people don't have great models, as researchers and neuroscientists don't have great models of exactly what kind of deficits arise when you have a problem like stroke, it's definitely generally known that there are a few things that you want to do to have an optimal rehabilitation, so in order to allow a patient to recover, to regain movement. One is quantity. You have to do a certain number of movements, and what you're trying to do, in particular I'm going to focus on a stroke because this is the big one, is that When you've had a stroke, you've lost some brain function, and if it happens in an area that has to do with human motor activity, you've got neural circuits which are broken, which are no longer sending commands to the parts that they need to be. And the idea of rehabilitation here through movement therapy is to develop new neural circuits, new pathways that can be used to get around the damaged parts of the brain. So quantity is important. Duration is important. You're going to be doing this for a long time. Intensity and repetition. And another issue is being task-specific. That's why a lot of rehabilitation is trying to do, you know, not just kind of moving your arms around in space, but picking up objects, feeding oneself, doing things that are going to be relevant to the activities of daily living. And that's actually one thing that robots are not so good at because of their sort of lack of portability. It's difficult to put them in task-specific situations. So I'd say currently this is the one thing that human physical therapists are much better at than robots. So what does a robot do for you? Well, obviously it can help with some of these issues like quantity, intensity, and duration. A lot of human physical therapists, they get tired. They can only work so many hours a day. Often they develop back problems, for example. So helping a stroke patient relearn how to walk requires a lot of physical support. It's a lot of physical therapists actually develop back problems after helping to try to carry patients around. And so, you know, robotic devices, assuming you don't need batteries, if you plug into a wall, they can obviously operate for very long periods. They don't get tired. And they can often provide forces or an intensity that could be larger than what a human therapist could. So in terms of actually what the robot can physically do to the patient, that is, what is the control strategy for the robot helping someone to regain movement, there's a number of different ways to do this. And we don't really know for sure which one is the best. It actually varies from patient to patient and depending on the type of deficit the patient has. So one example is assisting movement. And this sort of fits in, you know, very generally with the theme of assistive technology, in that if you have a patient that wants to move from here to here in order to grasp something, let's say they are wearing a robotic exoskeleton. That robotic device can recognize, either through some a priori statement or through eye gaze tracking, that there's some place that the user wants to reach. And so the robot can apply forces to the arm to help the user move the arm. So that might actually help the user accomplish the task. It's not clear if that always actually helps to rehabilitate the patient, because the patient can come to rely on the robot instead of actually recovering. And yet, there is an argument. There's something called Hebbian learning, which is the idea that just making the same movement over and over, even if it's not entirely volitional, sort of recognizing the sensory signals that are achieved during that movement, can help the user reconnect the lost neural circuits, even if they're not getting the same sort of muscle exercise that they would have if they're moving their own arm. So assisting movement could be a rehab strategy, but you have to be careful that the patients don't become completely reliant on the assistance and aren't trying to, you know, move towards independence, which is ultimately what you want. There's also challenging movement, and this is the opposite. The patient wants to move from here to here. You push them in a direction opposite, or maybe tangential, orthogonal to the direction that they're trying to move. And so, you know, that's the case where the patient wants to go from here to here, and the robot is pushing them this way. So they have to fight against it in order to go where they want to go. And that's really interesting because not only can it build up, it almost like overstrengthens the neural circuits that are trying to correct for errors in the movement. And it can also help improve muscle tone as well. The problem with this, there's this interesting effect that if someone, let's say you're operating in a force field that tries to push you orthogonally to your direction of movement, you do that a lot of times, and then suddenly you take away that force field because you're reaching in the real world, suddenly you overshoot the wrong way, right? You have this after effect from having trained in this kind of weird, unrealistic environment. While this could potentially be a good after effect if it's correcting a deficit that the patient has, it may not be quite right in terms of actually providing a rehabilitation. Sometimes there's just simulation of normal tasks. This kind of goes more with assisting movement, but if you could just get the robot to cause the human to move as if they were just doing the task on their own, then again, that could reconnect the neural circuits as desired. This last one is kind of interesting. It's become pretty popular, actually, as a research topic in the last few years. That's non-contact coaching, which I won't get into much in today's talk. But this is just the idea that there's no physical assistance from the robot at all, but the robot is simply encouraging, tracking data, encouraging based on the data that it's seen about how the patient is moving. So some people say, well, if there's going to be this non-contact coaching, you know, why does it have to be a physical robot? Why can't it just be your iPhone or a video that's talking to you? Well, research has shown that if the robot is like a physical entity and it becomes something that's sort of embodied in nature, that people are much more motivated in interacting with it. So people find that interacting with a robot can encourage someone to do more repetitions, like a stroke patient to do more repetitions, than if a video avatar or something like that is encouraging and doing the exact same motions and talking. So it is interesting that a physical robot doesn't have to be humanoid. Often they look like cute animals, can accomplish this non-contact coaching. All right, so in giving you kind of an overview of what's happened in rehabilitation robotics, it's pretty much over the last 20 or 30 years, I've gotten this sort of way of thinking about the field from Mike Vanderloos, who actually used to be here at Stanford and also at the Palo Alto VA and is now a professor at UBC, University of British Columbia, not UC Berkeley. And so the history of the field, you could say it started out with trying to develop robots that would just replicate what current human physical therapists do. And then researchers started thinking about trying to augment the therapist. What can we do that human physical therapists can't do? And then the super therapist, you'll see when we get there, is being able to do really novel things that require the acquisition and analysis of data that a human observer just couldn't even have access to. And the inner therapist is more about encouraging and motivation of the patient, him or herself. So let's look at some of these phases. So the first one, replicating the therapist, these actually come from the group that was at Stanford / Palo Alto VA that Dave was actually instrumental in being a part of. And feel free to chime in, actually, if you want to say anything about these systems.
Yeah,
In this system, the robot, this is a MIME, Mirror Image Movement Enabler. So the idea here was that if you had an arm which from the side of the brain that was still intact, you would provide commands with that arm, and then your arm with the movement deficit would be moved by this robot to mimic the motion of the master side. So one of the things that I work on in my lab, more for surgical robotics and such, is this idea of teleoperation. Like you could have a master joystick and control some remote robot. You can kind of think of this like teleoperating yourself, right? You teleoperate by putting an input with one hand, and the other hand is moved by this robot. And the advantage to a system like this could be that the patient does have some control over how the therapy is proceeding. The disadvantage is it's still sort of an assistive task in that the robot is moving the arm that has the deficit and the patient isn't having to actively move it. But the idea is that with this sort of bimanual task, you still might help reconnect some of the neural circuits which have been lost in stroke. But you can do this with assisted. You can also do it with the resistive technique. So there are not a whole lot of, I would say, highly successful rehabilitation robotics companies. As you probably learned with assistive technology, it's hard to kind of meet the cost point with the demand and the ability of the people that need the technology to actually purchase it. And definitely the same is true in rehab robotics. But this is one company that's actually survived for quite a while. It came out of MIT, and so originally the device was called the MIT Manus, and now it's a company called InMotion that has probably been in operation for, I don't know, I feel like 15 or almost 20 years now. And this system is much simpler than the one that was shown on the previous slide. This is a 2-degree of freedom joystick, essentially. It allows you to move your arm in the plane. And it's associated with this graphical virtual environment where you're asked to go hit targets and play little games, which can be motivating for the patient. So in this case, the other hand is not involved. And you simply try to hit the target, and it can either assist you or do this resistive control that I talked about earlier. And this robot, far more than any other rehab robot, has been tested in a lot of clinical studies of rehabilitation. And to be honest, the results are mixed, in part just because stroke patients themselves have such a wide variety of level of deficit, and the same sort of protocols don't work for everyone. But they have definitely been able to show in some sort of sub-patient populations that practice with this robot can actually lead to recovery more quickly than traditional physical therapist, human physical therapist-based activities. Another example, I just show it. It has pretty much the same sorts of capabilities, but these devices come in all shapes and sizes. So this is an example that rather than kind of being a planar tabletop device, aims to move the user, allow them to move in different degrees of freedom. Because while there are a lot of tasks where we kind of move in this plane when you're working on the tabletop, a lot of sort of vocational activities require your arms to move in planes like this. And so this arm guide is just another example of a robotic device that has sort of a larger workspace that can be appropriate for learning different types of tasks. Okay, so the second phase now was rather than just having robots that could do the kinds of things that physical therapists do, augmenting the therapist was sort of giving them more novel environments and allowing more motivation. So this is another example that Dave was involved with. This is from the Palo Alto VA, and Larry Leifer, who's a faculty member here, worked a lot on this project, which is the driver's seat. And the idea here was to motivate rehabilitation through a driving-like environment. So rather than the typical kind of manipulandum sort of thing, you would move this steering wheel. And it was specially instrumented. It was kind of cut in half between the left and right halves of the steering wheel, so you could apply different forces or torques on the left and right halves. You could do all sorts of interesting things with this in terms of playing with a virtual environment for driving, which the users found very motivating. So you could still do this kind of mime self-teleoperation thing where you moved one hand and the other one would move. You could also kind of lessen the effects of the strong hand and force the weak hand to work harder. There are a lot of games that you could play with a system like this. In fact, there's a close-up. I forgot I have this slide, which shows some of the force sensors, load cells on there. So the user would actually have to apply significant torque to the system in order to get the driving simulator to work. So here's another example. This one is based on a device. It was really built for haptics. It was called Haptic Master. Haptics is the field of creating virtual environments and feeling teleoperated remote environments that you can interact with through the sense of touch. So there's a company that had developed this kind of large workspace haptic device for people to feel virtual environments. So if you were a car designer and you had a virtual car, you could grab onto the end of this and feel its surface. And in this case, they took this haptic device and they turned it into a rehabilitation robot. So the big European Union project, where the subjects, again, could play a lot of really interesting games with the system, and it had a very large workspace, moving the arm around more than would be even easy for a human physical therapist to do. Okay, this super therapist idea now, going beyond the setups that we had earlier. So this is the kind of thing that a human physical therapist just can't do to a patient. And these are like crazy plots, right? So I'm going to walk through them a little bit. Okay, so this was this idea I talked about where you have resistive forces that force you to like learn new movement patterns, and then when you take those away, you have an after effect. And the hope is that that after effect could be beneficial to a patient, like a stroke patient. So here's an example. So if a stroke subject is making reaches like this, so they're supposed to be making point-to-point targeted reaches, and if you have normal movement patterns, the lines would look very straight. They might be a little bit curved, but you're not going to have these same sort of funny shapes at the end, this kind of weird overshoot and backtracking. It would pretty much look like straight lines to the target. And so that would be this first case. Now, this second one is called late machine learning. What they're doing is as the user is making reaches, they're computing what sideways forces would I need to apply to the user to get them to make straight movements. So they're just recording data from stroke patients as they continue to make these movements and start figuring out how would I have to push them, what arrows would I need to apply in order to allow them to move in a straight fashion. Then there's these C and D are early and late training. Now you actually apply forces in the opposite direction to the ones that you've computed to get the user to move straight. So the user has to push even harder to get to where they want to go. And so it's this resistive training. And in the beginning, it really messes with their movements. But in the end, actually, the users can kind of adapt to that, and they start to move more straight. And so you see they get straighter. When you take these extra forces away, the idea is, in the end, is that does what the patient learned balance out with the sort of their new dynamic forces that they're used to feeling in the arm, so that they actually make straight movements. And so early washout means right after you took away the sort of weird disturbing forces, and the hope is that the subjects will hold on to that new learned movement pattern. These pictures actually show nice straight line movements after this kind of training. Unfortunately, the very final story of this is that if you took the patients back, there's two parts of that story. So one is if you took them back weeks later, they had lost what they had learned, and they weren't back to these straight line movements. They would go back to their original pattern. But it was promising that you could at least even get them to hold on to it for a few hours. The other interesting issue with this kind of work is the context is so important. When the brain sort of relearns to make movement and connects neural circuits, sometimes it does so in the context of a particular environment. And in this case, they were working with one of these kind of planar manipulandum robots, and they learned it in the context of that robot. And so if they just let go of the robot and went out in space and tried to, you know, move their arm freely, then they would be back to their old deficits, because the learning that they had done was in the context of this robot. And interestingly, we've seen this with all types of systems. One of my collaborators works on gait. And so people that have an asymmetric gait, they kind of walk like this, they have this split-belt treadmill where one half of the treadmill goes faster than the other. And if you can actually correct someone's gait by adjusting the speeds of the two belts, it's pretty fun to do, actually. You can also adapt to it if you're a healthy person. You start walking when one's going slower than the other, and at first you kind of limp and walk funny, but then actually you can adapt to it over time and you can wind up developing a very smooth gait. But then as soon as they tie the belts together again so that they're moving at the same speed, then you have this after effect. So it's interesting, you can do the same sort of thing with walking. But the point of bringing up this treadmill issue is that as soon as the patients or even healthy subjects jumped off the treadmill onto regular overground walking, they would lose everything that they learned, because for some reason the brain associated that learning, that new movement pattern, with the device that they were walking on. And so there is still this issue of how do you really hold on to this for long periods of time, because that's what you need for true rehab. Some other examples is, again, just like getting people out of chairs and potentially into much more realistic situations. And this does get to this issue of context and transfer to normal activities of daily living, where now you've got a crazy VR environment with glasses and kind of a cave-like display, so that the virtual world that you're immersed in as you're training is as realistic as possible. Like, you try to put the person in an environment where it feels like they're moving in the real world. Graphically, they erase the fact that there's a physical robot that they're attached to, and try to make it seem like they're just moving in free space. So it's like, how do you trick the brain to remove the fact that you're learning in this particular context? Now, this image of this does look pretty artificial, and so you might not think it looks realistic, but if you're actually inside a cave environment that had, like, really realistic video, you know, on all sides of your face, you might not notice you're walking on a treadmill. You might think you're just walking over ground. All right, this last phase, which Mike Vandeleus called enabling the inner therapist, is, again, more related to motivation. And so there's some folks doing work where you look at the change in the patient's behavior, both from a kind of movement data aspect, like how fast they're moving or how hard they're pushing, but as well as the emotional state, like the arousal and valence of a patient, doing things like recording skin galvanic response to look for stress, EEG caps to measure brain activity, and directly using that to tell the robot, you know, we should push this patient a little harder, or they're getting too tired, you should lighten up, and just being able to associate the robot behaviors more directly with what that particular patient is feeling and doing at any instant. And that's definitely become a hot area in the rehab context. So most of the devices I showed you, I guess all the devices I showed you before, were upper limb and devices. And so I just thought I'd put in a little extra section on lower extremity robots. Upper limb you see a lot more of because they're easier to build. There's not as many safety issues. If you have, you don't have to worry about supporting the weight of the patient. But there's some really exciting devices that are developed on the lower extremity end. So I'm going to show a few of these. So this is not the split belt treadmill idea. These are actual robots that help someone, you know, move their leg into the correct position or support their body weight. And so you have examples like this. Sorry, this is actually a snippet from a video, so it's kind of fuzzy in here. But the person's actually wearing an exoskeleton robot on their leg, where the joints of the robot are aligned with the joints of the leg. That makes it especially hard to design exoskeletons because they have to fit different sized people, but you better make that rotational joint of the robot match the rotational joint of the human who's wearing it. Otherwise, yeah, kinematically, bad things will happen. These can actually provide assistance in getting leg swing happening at the right time for rehabilitation. The Locomot is probably, I talked about InMotion being the most successful commercial robot from the hand side of things, the arm side of things. This Locomot is the most successful commercial robot in terms of body weight support and gait retraining. And you can see that is a very large and likely very, very expensive device. And so most clinics can't afford this. I would say it's mostly used at really high-end research centers, where it's really being used as a research tool. Like, it really can't support itself yet as a clinical tool, but they've actually still sold a lot of these because there's so many clinics that are pushing towards this technology.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, great. Do you know how much they use it at the moment?
It's still unclear whether or not they people get
it. Right. Yeah. So, you know, there are questions with all of these rehab robots about the benefits, and it's not proven for a lot of them. I brought this one up. This is just very interesting because it's a very different kind of rehab robot. It's a balance trainer. So it's sitting on one of these sort of steward platform robots, which is kind of like if you've ever sat in a flight simulator or seen one of these flight simulators that moves around a whole box that you're sitting in. It's basically the same idea. And in this case, it's not a robot that moves any of your limbs around, but it disturbs your balance and you have to react to it. And the nice thing about this is it disturbs your balance and you have to adjust, but you're sort of strapped into it so that you can't actually fall over. And this is also done at University of British Columbia. Okay, so that was just kind of an overview of the field of rehab robotics and the way it's kind of developed over the years. I'm happy to take questions now before I shift over to talking a little bit about what we do in our lab. Yeah. That's a really good question. There's two aspects of the visual display. One is just to provide targets and information about where the hand is. And some of the robot systems, like there's one that we made in our lab that actually overlays the visual display over the hand, so it's actually correctly spatially aligned. And the other issue, I guess, is that the games kind of could be more fun potentially with this sort of visual feedback. I don't know that there have been explicitly studies about how the type of display affects the ability to do rehabilitation. in part because each study is so complex to do, the researchers will put together the very best system that they think they can and test that. And I have to say the field is not very good at doing comparative studies to say, what if we take this away and change this, then what will happen? Because typically they only have enough patients to kind of test the one thing, and there's no sort of control group with a different stimulus other than the control group that gets no rehab robot at all. Does that answer your question? Okay. Great. So I can spend a little bit of time introducing you to the kind of work that we do in our lab. This is a very long and specific title, and you'll see what it means very shortly. So in my research, when I got started, I worked with a neurologist at Kennedy Krieger Institute in Johns Hopkins who was really interested in helping work with patients who have damage to the cerebellum. So the cerebellum is a part of your brain. It's down here towards the lower base, about just above the neck. And the role of the cerebellum is thought to be that it houses an internal model of your body's dynamics. That is where it's stored, a model of your inertia and your limb segments, so that if you have to make a quick movement, you don't have to rely on slow sensory feedback. You can just say, given the model I know of my body, like these are the muscle outputs that I need to do to go there quickly. But that's not known for sure. There are a lot of parts of the brain where there are theories about what they do, and it can be very difficult to figure out what is the role of that part of the brain exactly. The interesting thing, you know, I learned in working with neuroscientists is that these specialized patient populations who have damage to very particular parts of the brain provide this window into the function of that part of the brain, because you can compare their behavior to that of people that don't have that same damage. And that's the case with cerebellar patients. So on one hand, these cerebellar patients are really fascinating because we can use them to uncover the role of the cerebellum, because we can compare their movements to those of people that don't have damage. On the other hand, they're also a really interesting patient population because they're notoriously difficult to rehabilitate. Nobody has found a way to help these people regain their movement capabilities once their cerebellar damage has occurred. And there's no pharmacological treatment. And I'll show in a minute what happens in a cerebellar patient. So here's just some data. She's giving a very simple example of what happens during reaching. So a control subject or a healthy person would just make these straight line movements to a target. Cerebellar patients, not too unlike a stroke patient, and in fact, some strokes occur in the cerebellum, although the patients we work with have genetic deficits, which are causing their movement. So we actually do studies only with pure cerebellar patients due to genetic problems to be sure that we're only looking at problems with the cerebellum. In any case, they tend to have these sort of curved motions, and they overshoot in some characteristic ways. And the question is, can you compare this to this and like a detective kind of back out what exactly does the cerebellum do in the healthy people that is not there in the cerebellar patient, and how does that tell us what the role of the cerebellum is in a very quantitative way? So this is what I was looking for earlier. This is a video of a cerebellar patient doing a very classic, I think it's a chin to finger pointing task. And he's actually not doing too bad. He's definitely one of the healthier patients that we've tested. But compared to people without cerebellar damage, we can make these movements a lot quicker and a lot more precisely. Cerebellar patients are also thought to purposely move slowly, because having knowledge of your body's dynamics isn't as important when you move slowly, because I can use that sensory feedback, which is kind of a slow loop to look with your eyes, feel with your arms where they are, and then close a control loop that way. But if you want to move quickly, you have to have a very good internal model of the body's dynamics. Yeah?
It seems like that patient has more dysmorphia on one side than the other. Is it the cerebellum? Is it on one side of the brain?
So you can actually have, there's like a left and right cerebellum actually, as there is with the brain. And so you can have deficits that affect one side or the other side or both. absolutely. Another thing to point out from the video is this patient has a lot of, like, intention tremor, which is kind of a separate issue. He gets close to the target, he kind of shakes around a little bit, even when he's not trying to move fast, and that's a bit of a different issue from the cerebellar deficit we're looking at. Okay, so how did we approach this problem? Well, we were just interested in decoding the role of the cerebellum. So we had this exoskeleton robot, which is different from the kind that, like, strap onto your arms or legs. It basically has these two arm trays, which are each a planar manipulandum. And so it's kind of safe in the sense that you're not strapped to it, and therefore it's much easier to use clinically with patients. So you move like this. And I think I have a video of it in a second. And the nice thing about an exoskeleton robot, and why we use an exoskeleton and not one of these manipulandums where you hold onto the endpoint, is because with an exoskeleton, you are really kind of automatically tracking and applying torques or forces to the whole arm. If you hold onto the kind of endpoint of a robot, the rest of the arm could be doing a lot of different things, right? And so you might only know what's going on in the hand. All right, so I guess we'll get to the robot video in a minute. So to give an example of a kind of study that we've done with this system, this one's very simple. All we're doing was asking the subjects to move from here to here, a single movement of arm flexion. All right, and so if you're trying to move from, we'll start with 0 degrees to 30 degrees, a healthy person would move very quickly, get right to the target and stay there. So this is time on the horizontal axis and position on the vertical axis. And then what's interesting, and this has been kind of one of the mysteries with cerebellar patients, is that some patients are hypermetric, which means they overshoot, they're hyper. Then there's also hypometric patients which undershoot, like they don't quite get to the target and then they have to correct. And there have been these two classes of patients, and it hasn't really been understood why, even what would cause these differences. So I'm going to skip over this stuff and just get ahead to what we did with these patients. So after measuring movements of a lot of patients, we came up with a potential model for the role of control in the brain and how it would work with cerebellar patients. And if we use that to estimate, for example, that a patient had a misestimate of their body's dynamics, like they thought that their arm inertia was 30% less than it actually is, or 30% more than it actually is. So we did this kind of system identification on the patients to figure out what exactly was causing their movement in terms of the dynamic model we expected them to have of their body. And then we're able to use the same exoskeleton robot, not just to record data, but to apply forces that make up for that deficit. So, for example, if you saw that a patient had, their brain thought that they had 30% less mass than it actually has, when the patient moves their arm with the robot, you could tell the robot to have a force proportional to acceleration, which creates effectively a mass, so it makes the patient's arm heavier or lighter as needed. And so physically, the robot can change the patient's physical dynamics to match the erroneous model in the brain. So while we can't fix the brain, we can fix essentially the arm to have these matching dynamics. Yeah?
How does that not force the patient to over or undercompensate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the interesting thing about cerebellar patients in comparison to, like, stroke patients and a lot of other patients is we haven't been able to show that they can actually learn and adapt to these forces. So this is actually very different from the stroke example I gave earlier, where people would adapt to some force field and then they take it away and they'd have an after effect. Cerebellar patients, they seem to have kind of a static deficit. Like once the cerebellar damage occurs, they're 30% off in inertia, and even if you tell them, you know, act as if you have less inertia or more inertia, they can't do it. Their brain is not able to process and behave in movement in that way. And so the patients actually, the interesting thing is a lot of them don't even notice that we've made these changes to their dynamics. And the dynamic changes, like I said, maybe 30% or so is at the most. They're actually kind of subtle. It actually has a big effect on the movement, but in terms of the forces you feel when you move, it might feel like you're moving a slightly heavier, slightly lighter robot. But it's a great question, and the cerebellar patients, is kind of precisely because they can't adapt that this actually works with this patient population. So the punchline is that by using the robot to change the dynamics of the user, we can actually improve their reaching. And it turns out that if their brain model thinks that the inertia is less than what the arm actually is, we can use the robot to make that match happen. And so if the patient has hypermetria, that is, they tend to have errors that are positive, we can improve them to come down to be similar to control subjects. And similarly, if you have patients with not enough inertia, we use the robot to increase it and allow them to move in a better way. So before the assistance and then after. So this isn't exactly rehabilitation in that because these patients don't adapt, we can't, you know, train them to reach better and then they can go out and do the activities of daily living as they like. But the fact that this worked at all, A, gives us insight into the role of the cerebellum, that it does seem to be indeed misestimates in arm dynamics, but it also is a potential assistive strategy. So actually some of these patients are now wearing matched weights just on the end of their arms, and it's actually helping sort of make their movements either damped out or and so this is only really working for patients that need to add weight. We can't remove a pound of flesh, as you can imagine, for those that should decrease weight. But some of them actually have been recommended to, you know, be able to do more exercise and reduce weight, and some of those patients have been able to improve as well. So it's not a rehabilitation strategy in that they've relearned something, but we found assistive methods that then work. Okay, I think I'm moving a little bit too slowly, and I know Dave has some other things he wants to say about robotics at the end, and I want to take a couple of questions. So I thought I would just throw out a couple other kinds of interesting things that my lab is doing, and one I'd like to mention is we're very interested in haptics, so touch feedback on different places in the body. And so one project we have is actually guiding people to make movements, and things like the Kinect have really enabled this because we can record movements in a non-contact way through something like the Microsoft Kinect, and then wearable haptic feedback devices can actually help guide movement. So that's something we've done for fun things like yoga and also looking at the potential to apply for stroke patients. But the big picture in all of our medical robotics work that actually ranges from surgical robotics to rehab robotics is that we really need to understand the patient's state better. And by that I mean to really have a model of the deficit. So in a surgical robot, you might want to have a model of the tissue. In a rehab robot, you might want to have a model of the deficit in the brain that is causing control issues. And that you should use those models to plan interventions that are very specific to a particular patient. And then finally, my definition of robotics is that you design devices, control, and processes that connect these plans, this information, to a physical action in the world. And it all has to be a system that interacts with humans in a very natural way. Okay, so I'll end there, and I can take a few questions before I hand it over to Dave. Yeah. Not her anymore. Got all the questions out of the back. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is if there are wearable exoskeletons. For this particular patient population, no. I think that's definitely one of the things that, yeah, long-term we're interested in doing. It's just that right now the design of exoskeletons, they're typically so heavy and bulky that cerebellar patients wouldn't be able to support them with some of the kind of movement problems that they have. It's definitely possible to have wearable exoskeletons like on single joints, and research groups have done that for other patient populations, but we don't think a single joint is really enough in real activities to help a cerebellar patient. So it hasn't been pushed too much. Good question. Yeah. So the question was about, tracking improvements through brain imaging. And so, you know, with fMRI now, functional MRI, it's really amazing the types of changes that you can see in patients, like before and after, say, a rehabilitation strategy of some kind. The problem is that we're definitely not at the point with such brain imaging that you could look at an image and predict, like, what kind of training they need to do. It's almost more like retrospective as a way of observing change that occurred, like, before and after. You can't really look at before and say, this is the thing that needs to be done to this patient. You can't use it to predict what sort of new scan you'll get later through a particular therapy. But the imaging side of things is really interesting, not one I've worked in.
The experiment where they applied that force field and
moved it,
you said that the effects last for a little while, but eventually...
Right.
I was just wondering, what kind of timeline? Hours?
Yeah, I think it was hours in this case, and again, specific to that, to using that robot. Even for healthy people, like depending on how long they train, if it's just a little while, you can see a big effect, and you can see a big after effect, but sometimes it can die away after just a few simple reaches. So it kind of depends on how long you've trained as well. Okay, thanks.
Yes. Well, I'm going to have to go through my stuff pretty quickly, but this will all be online, except for my voice. So if some of the things you miss are interesting, you're welcome to go back. So there's a lot of robots in our life. They come in all different forms and all different purposes. A lot of them are on TV. Assistive robots come in down here. They're under medical robots, and they provide manipulation tasks, physically assist people, and provide personal mobility. So my definition is a device that can sense, process information, and perform actions that benefit people with disabilities or older adults doing the things that they normally do in their life, and that includes, everything, and even going to school and learning and stuff like that. So anything that a robot can do, those things are assistive. Lots of people could benefit, as Allison said. Some early ones involved a manipulation device that's attached to a wheelchair, controlled by the chin. This is a desktop version that used in a vocational situation or enable a person to use a computer. It's a couple of projects from the VA. This is one that used these special wheels that I talked about, a Unimation arm, a controller in here, a hand that was specially made, a camera, and it was voice controlled and could operate over in a room. This is a vocational robot that was at the VA. User had a mouse stick to control a trackball here. The robot is hanging overhead on a track, able to pick up video discs and help them with their job. A slightly improved version and in color. Had a version that here's a better view of the arm. And this one actually was programmable by the user, so they could set up where the robot was to go themselves rather than having a technician do it. Other robots, a feeding robot that also does drinking, washing, shaving, and stuff. And the purpose of that is to also reduce care on demand on caretakers as well as provide independence for users. Lots of robotic arms on wheelchairs. There's been a number of versions of this over the years. And this robot, you know, helps you pick up things when they fall on the ground. Here's a navigation robot that employs a lot of ultrasonic sensors to find the clear path and probably can self-drive through that clear path. And here's a device that offers the same clear path navigation, but for people who can walk, and although this doesn't have wheels on it, it will only steer into a clear path and not into the wall or something like that. Lots of robots in the news. Here's a PR2 ordering Japanese food. Here's a PR2 from Little Garage doing dishes. This obviously has applications for people with disability or people who don't like to do dishes, okay? They can be used with older adults at home, but in reality, this device was too big to be used in a home environment. It was just too massive. Here's the backside of Henry Evans, and they programmed the robot with a very simple interface that he can control and have the robot do manipulation tasks for him. They did a study to see if these robots would be acceptable, and the answer is yes, unless these tasks involve personal care or social activities. You can see the scale of the robot with these people. It's just really out of place. So it was too big, but they tried. Exoskeletons, there's been a bunch of other attempts. This was a student project at Berkeley. Here's another version, and a third version at Vanderbilt. I'm not sure if these are how far along these are commercially, but it's good to know that other people are working on these things. And if you really want to be a super person, you know, a super soldier or a RoboCop, then you could have your own exoskeleton that you wear. This is a pretty interesting device. This is a robot that is coaching people in exercise therapy. So, and it actually has a camera and checks to see if you've done it. They also have an application of another robot like this that communicates with kids with autism and has them focused to do certain tasks like that. There's a bunch of these telepresence robots for hospitals, for contact with older folks. There's a movie Robot and Frank that looked at elder care robots helping these individuals with their independence. Here's a researcher project for an elder care robot that responded to voice commands. Some more of the same things for use in the hospital. And it's interesting, in this description, they call the user a care recipient, which is probably the worst term I've ever heard for a user. Vigo is a telepresence robot that is advertised to be used as a remote student. So if you're sick, you can actually come to this class, or you can visit somebody remotely. And then there's these weird robots from Japan. Here's one that will wash your hair for you. Okay, how many people would really appreciate having their hair washed for them? So this one is really clever. This is a wheelchair that turns into a bed. So it's part of the transformer movement in Japan, where you can have, two pieces of rehab equipment sort of merge together. And this is actually nice because you don't have to worry about transferring a patient, you know, from the bed to a wheelchair. So that's actually a pretty interesting idea. Lots of work with prosthetic arms. This one works on my electric signals from the stump. This is a really clever device. You know, lifting people is really hard on nurses and hospital workers. So if you can have a robot do that, that would be great. For companionship for the elderly, they made these baby robots. And there's a para robot, which I've seen. And this one was actually parodied on The Simpsons. And you throw a switch and it turned into an attack robot. So it provides therapeutic effects for seniors. And there's NSF is working in this area, encouraging social assistive robots. There's robots that are take over the work of service dogs. So if you don't want to work with the service dog, you can have a robot do that for you. You can play with the robot. You can have this wheelchair-mounted arm and interact with the people around you, pick up things. This one will actually find devices that you've dropped on the floor and pick them up. Another feeding robot for use in nursing homes. In classrooms, it can have robots, so the students could be students with disabilities as well. This is the one that engages children with autism. This is the weirdest one I've seen. This is a talking head. You can talk to it and it will carry on a conversation with you and move its lips and stuff like that. So human interaction. It's called Fur Hat. There's a nice video. So in summary, robots come in many forms. They can help all sorts of people and also take over tasks that caregivers might use. A lot of people doing one-of-a-kind prototypes. Not many of them are used because of their high cost and their insurance won't pay for them and things like that. So I can't believe I got through all these slides. So that's okay. Anybody have any questions on this? Okay. I'll have all the links up. A lot of these links have videos, so check that out. These are really interesting things. And there's hundreds and hundreds of people working on assistive robotics. So it's in the news almost every week. So thank you very much. See you on Thursday. Make sure you sign the attendance sheet. If you could drive in 2 weeks, please sign up here. Sign up here. And if you need to meet with me, another sign-up sheet and cookies, too. Thank you.